Hi everyone, welcome to the first ever episode of the Official Positions Podcast, where all positions are official no matter what you hear. I am your host, Davis Ellison. Thank you so much for listening. It is really exciting to be launching this whole podcast, but especially to be recording our first introductory episode, where we will sort of explore the concept of what this whole podcast will be about, and also give a little bit of a sneak peek of what is to come as we go along. So this whole concept of what we're trying to do here is it's to talk about the security studies, defense, foreign policy research, and academic world, and all of the different angles that we can. All of the good, all of the bad, all in one place to, one, have just another critical voice out there, but also to be a bit of a resource for maybe some early career researchers, other scholars, students from the BA all the way up through the PhD level, just to have a place to engage with some of these things, both in the US, but also in Europe, where I'm based. So with that, I guess a little bit about myself. As I said, I'm Davis Ellison. I am a researcher based here in the Netherlands. I am originally from the US. I'm, as of recording right now, right on the edge of finishing my PhD at the Department of War Studies at King's College in London. So all of this is my research background. I'm at a place called the Hague Center for Strategic Studies now. But prior to this, I was also a civilian staffer at NATO. So I've seen sort of the practitioner and research side, and importantly, and we'll come back to this, how those two sides interact with one another. So this first episode, you know, I said we're going to be talking about security studies, is to, you know, set the stage a little bit for exactly what we're talking about. So when I say security studies, I mean a pretty broad set of interrelated fields. You know, part of it is international relations, which is really connected to political science. But when I say it here, I do mean something a lot broader. What I really mean is the wider world of people writing and publishing about foreign policy, defense, the military, and of course, international relations. So this includes everyone from university professors, think tanks, you know, people talking heads on the news, so on, you know, people with columns. So that's pretty broad. But the whole world is super interrelated to each other and really insular. And many people go back and forth throughout these positions. So it's kind of hard to nail any one person or even organization down to one place. So it's broad. Some people use terms like the blob, the famous term that the American Ben Rhodes came up with a couple years ago. Some people include even government folks in this, like Stephen Walt at Harvard in his book, The Hell of Good Intentions. You know, he includes everyone from like State Department diplomats, intelligence analysts, people in Congress, so on and so forth. You know, certainly that government side and, you know, the research world's influence on it is something we're interested in here. But we're really looking at more of the academic and research side more specifically. So why is all of this important, not only just sort of intrinsically, maybe if you're in academia, if you are in university, why is it more interesting anyway? Especially, is any of this really actually that influential? Like all good research answers, it's both yes and no. No, in the sense that the community is really divorced from domestic politics. Professionally, it's uninterested in your healthcare, your job, pensions, whatever. So in the sense of actually meaning something for workers, people's jobs, so on and so forth, you know, the domestic world, it's really divorced from that. You know, one thing that we'll get into in a later episode is, you know, for example, the Biden administration's whole foreign policy for the middle class thing, which got a lot of breathless commentary from the security studies research crowd. It's basically just kind of a bunch of bullshit. The domestic side doesn't feature, but we'll come back to that more in a second. But yes, it's influential in that what this world engages with are issues of war and peace, huge amounts of government spending, nuclear war, what do we focus our attention on? And these people do get listened to in the professional practitioner circles. I can speak from experience myself at NATO that think tank reports, journal articles, things, these are read by people in the practitioner community, especially people who actually write strategies and policies. Maybe not the seniors, because they never have time for anything. But the people who actually have to work on this stuff are going to go somewhere for their sources of information, and that is where they turn. It's that security studies world. So it certainly is influential. So turning then, we've defined a little bit what security studies is. We've definitely landed on that it's influential. But what are some of the problems with it? What are going to be some of the things that we're talking about over the course of this podcast? So I already mentioned, first is that the security studies field does not care about domestic politics. Not really. It doesn't really care about opportunity costs between what you spend on defense versus social care, welfare state spending, and so on. And that is, I would say, it's to such an extent that it reaches actually being an analytical blind spot. It thinks as these trade-offs only in terms of different military options. Should we have more of this kind of missile, less of this kind of weapon system, so on and so forth? Should we be in Asia or should we be in Europe? Versus thinking maybe a bit more horizontally and thinking about, well, how does doubling down in wherever, the Pacific, how does that impact our ability to do welfare state spending here? How does it impact if we're talking about conscription here in Europe, how does that impact workers? How does that impact the economy? That's not something that the security studies world is really equipped to deal with. It's not something that it's comfortable with. And I think that's where it connects into the second piece, where the field writ large, and that, again, it's very broad, like I said, doesn't at least admit to itself, or I haven't met many researchers who admit to how politically conservative the field is. So back to those trade-offs, of course the field is going to talk about things, and if it does talk about domestic politics, it's going to say, well, the people need to give up their healthcare spending so we can have more of this in the military and so on. That's a conservative take. That's a politically conservative take. That's not just, sort of an objective bean counting kind of thing. Many of these institutes are openly conservative. You have ones in DC, like the American Enterprise Institute, the Heritage Foundation, the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, the Atlantic Council, I would even say. But that's not put in those terms. And on the receiving end of their influence, of their research and their outputs and so on, that conservatism isn't acknowledged. The number of times I saw Heritage Foundation reports being passed around in really serious professional circles, whether that's in the Pentagon, NATO, elsewhere, was actually pretty shocking to me, not only because I'm on the progressive side, the left side of politics. It was also just seeing how a nakedly partisan outfit was being approached and understood as a very neutral expert organization. And I would also say that amongst researchers here in Europe, it's really not understood well in the European security studies research world how conservative so many of the other American organizations are. In some cases they do know, but in general they don't. Whether that's the Hudson Institute, I already mentioned Heritage, but unless you're really extremist, the America First Policy Institute or something like that, it goes unaddressed. Which I would say is actually an issue, because that has a knock-on effect over here in the research world, where, again, it's perpetuating that conservatism. It's not thinking about different kinds of trade-offs. It's a very blinkering way of thinking about the world. And it's not thinking about it even in terms of, the actual domestic politics here in Europe. The Republican Party does not operate here in Europe. Though it seems like some people here might want it to, which is a concern in and of itself that I'm sure we'll come back to. But it is an analytical problem that sort of radiates out from Washington, but that's certainly not the only one. Turning to the others, there's, I guess I can describe it as a demographic issue in security studies, and that's that the whole field is just so deeply white and deeply male, and again, deeply conservative, sometimes even to a religious extent if we're talking in the US. And that is analytically an issue. There's, you know, it's not only, you know, a sort of on principle issue, an ethical issue, but it's an analytical issue where you have voices from outside of the transatlantic world, people who, you know, didn't make all their bones going through Harvard and the State Department and the Fulbright Fellowship and so on and so forth, but who have hugely important insights on the rest of the world and lived experience that should be shaping our thinking about defense and security and foreign policy making, but they are systematically excluded. That's not only in the academic world, whether it's hiring or representation in departments or think tanks, but even if you're engaged in any of the closed door sessions, sort of the track two, track 1.5 discussions that happen between, you know, experts, so-called experts, and government officials, you know, anybody who does not just sort of sing the song of, you know, kind of white nationalist, militarist, you know, imperialism kind of thing, you know, they just really get excluded. They get downplayed. I've seen this again and again, you know, advocates for arms control, advocates for more equitably restructuring the international system, people who are critics of militarism or the military, such as it is, all get downplayed. Even if they're not excluded, they get downplayed. And you can see it, whether it's the way a panel gets moderated, the way an agenda gets set, or which authors get to be on a paper. But it does happen quite a bit, even in, you know, over here in Europe, which I think is generally better in that regard. It's certainly more equitable. I've met more women researchers, for example, over here than I ever did back in the United States. But I think the outside the Atlantic world, so, you know, your South America, writers from any corner of Africa, they just don't feature nearly as heavily, especially in the think tank community here. And you just have to see any of the events that happen to know that. The fourth issue, switching topics a little bit, but perhaps not unrelatedly, if you take some of the sort of way people write and talk about this world as sort of a demonstration of masculinity, it's the fetishism of the military and war in this world. And I think the best example of that is being seen right now in Ukraine, where you just have think tanker after think tanker, professor after professor lining up to go get their picture taken visiting Kyiv or visiting, you know, troops somewhere near the battlefield in Ukraine. Now, this isn't a, you know, criticism of Ukraine. Of course, they're trying to get the word out. I'm obviously, you know, on their side in this war, but it is being fetishized in the defense and security studies research world. People want to get that clout. They want to get their picture taken, you know, in their quasi-combat fatigues, trying to look all cool. They're going to have that picture up on their wall when they go back to the whatever Institute for Defense Analysis or Atlantic Council or Chatham House over here, so on and so forth. You know, I've seen that all the time with Ukraine. Tons of people from the International Institute for Strategic Studies, RUSI, the Royal United Services Institute. I see it all over the place. And it's just kind of gross. You know, we saw it a lot in Afghanistan and Iraq too. You know, we started calling it the dusty Kevlar picture, people who just fly to Afghanistan for 3 days, strap on some body armor, get their picture taken with a couple of soldiers, and then fly back to their, you know, wood paneled office and, you know, enjoy their life back in Europe. And it just feels itchy. It trivializes the fighting that's going on. It trivializes the lived experience of people in those countries, and it treats it like theater. It's all PR. It's gross. And there's this one example I especially remember from the Iraq War of Michael O'Hanlon, a quite famous American defense author, affiliated with the Institute for Defense Analyses, written tons of books over the years. And it was sometime during the surge in Iraq, which is, you know, questionable in and of itself. And he was something that someone who was a big supporter of that, getting a picture taken of him with like a couple of Marines before they went out on patrol. And it's just such a stark, weird image of, you know, these guys about to go engage in this, you know, war, in this, you know, patrolling as a force of occupation in this country. And he's there with his little notepad off to the side writing. And it's just very odd. So, yeah, war is fetishized. It's a demonstration of just guys trying to look as masculine as they can. There's a competition around it, and it's just kind of a gross tendency. And I think it is something that's actively wrong. I don't know that it's analytically wrong, but I think it's an on-principle thing that I think is wrong in the security studies world. And then the last fifth one that I'll talk about today, at least, is how so many people, and I'll focus here in Europe, but it's not exclusive, are trying to be, all trying to be a little American. You know, so many people over here who are in think tank positions, who are in university jobs in some cases, all did their time, usually in the United States, doing some kind of fellowship or meeting with people from the Pentagon or State Department, and they're really just trying to mimic the way American thinkers approach some of these issues in security and defense, despite the fact that they are, you know, not from A, not from the U.S., and B, have their own, you know, country situation to think about. And I think a part of that mimicry gets back to where the security studies world is, you know, has some really deeply embedded imperialist tendencies built into it, all the way from its real foundation as an academic field, you know, roughly a century ago or a little bit longer. Where, you know, you have European scholars and researchers trying to prove their relevance or their credibility or seriousness to Big Brother American organizations. It's weird to see. And it's kind of uncomfortable in my own situation, you know, being an American based over here, sort of in the reverse direction, especially being a more progressive, restraint-minded person, seeing, you know, Europeans trying to out-hawk each other in front of the Americans. It's a very odd situation to see, and one that I think that is very detrimental to some of the thinking and analysis that you see coming out of here sometimes. For example, you get people talking about, I don't want to name names too aggressively quite yet, but you do see, you know, quite a few people, and you just look up the War on the Rocks and your usual outlets, and you'll see people from European institutes saying, like, you know, we need to send troops with the Americans to the Pacific, you know, we need to stand by them in the Middle East, and so on and so forth, over years and years and years. And it just doesn't make any sense. You know, why should the Belgians send anything to the Pacific with the Americans? Why should the Spanish send anything over there? It doesn't make absolutely any sense. For it means nothing to people here in Europe. It benefits nobody here in Europe, and it certainly doesn't benefit anybody in the regions of the world that we're talking about. And I think one of the worst examples of the foreign policy mimicry has been seen with the latest Israel-Gaza war. The number of European states that have lined up behind the United States, not recognizing Palestine as a state, refusing to criticize the Netanyahu government's, you know, killing of tens of thousands, you know, despite the fact that the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice are based here in the Netherlands, and both those courts have credibly accused Israel of genocide. And that's, again, you know, they're just mimicking the United States. There's an Australian author, Clinton Fernandez, I think he's still at the University of Melbourne, but he has a book and a whole concept talking about sub-imperialism. It's when states that are especially in alliance with the United States are these really enthusiastic, eager members of, you know, following America around the world and trying to demonstrate its relevance to Washington. And, you know, that's how these states get themselves in quagmires left and right, or supporting, you know, just straight up evil policies around the world just to try to be friendly with the Americans. It's very weird. And again, analytically odd. And it's one of the reasons why there hasn't been much of a serious thinking about Europe's independent role in the world. Now, I'm extremely cautious about that, too, because before the era of, you know, American power, you know, Europe's independent role in the world was sure as hell not a good one. you know, it colonized most of the known planet and did terrible things around the world. So it's not that I'm necessarily incredibly supportive of that concept, but the alternative shouldn't just be follow the Americans either. You know, there's not a realistic thinking about Europe's place in the world. And I think part of that also reinforces, you know, European researchers and security studies scholars thinking about Europe in incredibly grandiose outsized terms that just don't make any sense. You know, these are, even collectively as Europe, these are relatively small countries with, you know, not a lot of power on the world stage anymore. And frankly, I think some of the most convincing arguments is all their empires fell apart 50, 60 years ago. The Americans built up their empire and now they get to, you know, coattail with the big guys again just by following the Americans. It's you know, hurtful but truthful, and it gets reflected not only in the style of thinking but even gets reflected in the style of analysis here. So these are really the five things. You know, the security studies world kind of in a broad sense doesn't think about domestic issues enough. It ignores how politically conservative it is. It's very tied in with issues of whiteness and masculinity. It's fetishist about war. And for Europeans especially, they're all just trying to be little Americans. So these are some of the five issues that we're talking about. Now, I'll start wrapping it up here. We're going to come back to all of these issues in one way or another as we go through the episodes. We have a couple of other episodes coming up, which will be coming out roughly every 2 weeks or so. Sometimes I'll push out something sooner. The next one is going to be about what's it like studying defense and foreign policy between the United States and Europe. So that's really geared towards our students out there. And it's going to be especially reflective of my experience studying in both Europe and the U.S. And third, how a bit more personal, how I went from sort of this uber hawk. I was raised in a very Republican part of the United States, how I went from this very conservatively minded, hawkish person to where I am now, very much of the progressive left and advocating for those policies, including in foreign policy. So that will be our third episode. The fourth one, again, back to our students, we're going to be looking at our reading lists and how we can decolonize those, both in topics and in authorship. So that I'm really excited about that one. I love talking about books. I do plenty of book reviews too, so I'm looking forward to that one. And then our fifth one, I'm going to hand over the reins a little bit to some friends of mine, and we're going to talk about women in security studies, back to that third issue I talked about before. So this is really the lineup coming. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, so on. I'm also on all the socials, Davis Ellison, and also have our Substack official positions where I'll be writing and publishing a little bit. All free access. This isn't about making money. This is all about just having some good discussions and getting some critical thinking out there. So again, thank you all so much for listening. Thank you for joining for our first ever episode, and we look forward to hearing you on the next one.